You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina.
Well, hello and welcome to the cycling podcast Feminan. It's April. It's the time of year that we love, don't we? Because the classics are just coming thick and fast. That would be actually a perfect little segue into introducing my two co-hosts. I'll let you guys argue over who is thick and who is fast.
I'll take the thick.
I thought you were going to say we were classics.
You can be the old classic, Denny, and I'll be the thick but still, I'm not sure I'm still fast, thick but still relatively quick.
Well, okay, I guess you both kind of managed to compliment yourselves there somewhere. But yes, I should introduce more formally the old classic that is Denny Gray.
Thank you.
And Lizzie Banks, who I think is definitely fast, no doubt, is definitely not thick.
Thank you.
Unless you've been having a lot of waffles.
I mean, I did have a lot of waffles. I've not been doing quite so much cycling. I'm definitely thicker than I used to be and definitely less fast than I used to be. So the thick and slightly less fast Lizzie Banks. Hello, Rose. Thanks for the lovely introduction. Lovely to be here too.
You're very, very welcome. Well, I've actually caught up with both of you, haven't I, in recent weeks because we've had two arrives, one from Flanders, one from Paris-Roubaix, which you both joined me on. So we've kind of heard a little bit of your knee-jerk reactions to those particular races. But now we've had a bit of distance from them. I say that with like having had a few days off from Paris-Roubaix. I just wonder how can we classify this classics season, cobbled classics season, I should say. Lizzie, what was your kind of major takeaway from the cobbled classics that we've had?
I think I'm just going to be repeating myself by saying, you know, the sort of emergence of Franzi Koch as a superstar. But I just don't think that you can look back at the classics and not say how important that has been. You know, Franzi's been there in every single one of the major classics and then coming away and winning Paris-Roubaix at the end. May I add, after me predicting that she would, which I'm very disappointed that I didn't put actual money on.
I know. Well, that's what you said in the arrive, didn't we, Denny? That I actually couldn't believe it took this long, Lizzie, before you gloated with that one. But we did say in the arrive, we hoped that you put some money on it because it was a fantastic shout. You know, first thing on Sunday morning, just to say that Franzi Koch was going to win it, because I think you would have got some good, I don't know how much you would have got, but you would have got a good amount.
Well, the frustrating thing is I'd been thinking it since Wednesday, since I sort of started thinking about, you stopped thinking about the previous race of Flanders and started moving on to the next race. And I was thinking, Franzi's going to win this, you know, unless I can't claim to have Denny's crystal balls or any sort of voyeuristic traits. But, you know, looking at everything that had happened, looking at the flow of the races, the type of rider she is, the type of race it is, the hunger that she had, it just seemed like everything was up for grabs with that. On a sort of spiritual women's cycling fan level, I would have loved Marianne Vos to win, but I was only rooting for Franzi Koch purely because that morning on the Sunday I'd said to you guys, just so it's on the record, I think she's going to win. And yeah, as soon as the coverage came on with 50 kilometers to go, she was there in like, you know, fourth, fifth position, always right there, not at the front, but in the front, exactly where she needed to be. And obviously we missed so much of the action beforehand, which is a point where you can lose the race just by having used so much energy. Yeah, she was just in the perfect position. And I shouldn't fall into the trap of rehashing everything from Roubaix. But yeah, when you ask about my big takeaways from the classic season, it absolutely, without a doubt, has to be Franzi Koch and just her strength and now sort of absolute integral nature of her as a key rider into the FDJ United Suez team.
Yeah, I think it was on actually the Tour of Flanders arrive, wasn't it, Lizzie, that I was kind of going through how integral as a domestique Franzi Koch has been, because the fact that every race that she's been in, she's placed, you know, in the top. I mean, she came fifth in Omloop, and obviously her teammate Demi Vollering won. She came third in Strade Bianche. Obviously, Elise Chabet won, her teammate. So she's been kind of absolutely integral to the team and still finishing so highly. So I think it's even more well-deserved, this Paris-Roubaix win, isn't it? That's a real kind of thank you, Franzi, for everything you've done for this team. But she kind of did it on her own. We saw her kind of having to outgun the Visma Lisa bike riders. Undoubtedly, the team got into a good position, and you kind of do need the team to help you have your position on the road in something like Paris-Roubaix, making sure you're going into every cobbled section on the front. But I mean, I did think, Denny, it was a fantastic solo performance, wasn't it? And to come away beating the might of Visma Lisa Bike, on a very emotional day for them.
Yeah, it was a brilliant solo performance. And I think just as her rise has been one of the stories of the spring, I think also her team has been one of the stories of the spring, haven't they? I mean, they've won four major races now, Omloop, Het Nieuwsblad, Strade Bianche, Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, with three different riders. And I think one of the things that I've perhaps enjoyed, although I never like seeing one team dominate, but is the fact that, watching riders like Elise Chabet and Franzi Koch, they're riders that have always ridden partly as domestiques or super domestiques, and seeing them kind of rise to win these major races has been really enjoyable. And actually the contrast we kind of enjoyed, and we talked a lot about SD Works falling apart before Damie Vollering left, didn't we? And although it's easy for things to seem rosy from the outside when you're winning, I think what strikes me about the FDJ United team is that they genuinely do seem united, and the riders are very happy to ride for each other. Not just Franzi Koch and Elise Chabet riding for Damie Vollering and vice versa, but also we've seen in the past Juliette Labousse kind of turning herself inside out for Damie Vollering. So that's going to be one to watch, because we know how dangerous they can be in the stage races as well. And I think we talked when Vollering joined the team that maybe Evita Musique and Juliette Labousse would be the ones kind of rising up and taking the crown of team leaders. So it's interesting that actually the kind of new stars have been a bit left field, like Chabet and Franzi Koch.
I did want to actually ask Lizzie a question off the back of that, because of the fact that I remember when we were talking about Strade Bianche and Elise Chabet winning that, Lizzie, you were kind of keen to say that this wouldn't put the idea in Elise Chabet's head that she was going to now be the leader and go forth and get more wins. I wondered that question again now that Franzi Koch has won Paris-Roubaix. For those riders, Chabet and Koch, do you think this is a turning point in terms of them becoming the out-and-out leaders in the future, and the team actually building the calendar around what those riders can also do alongside Demi Vollering?
No and yes, because I think that I stand by what I said, in that I think that when it comes to going into a race with Demi Vollering as the leader, I still don't believe that Elise Chabet and Franzi Koch, with the type of riders they are and the type of personalities that they are, would go into that with this thought that, oh, well, maybe I can do it. Maybe I can, if I save a little bit, I can win in the end. And let's give the example of Lotte Kopecky and Lorena Wiebes here. How many times when SD Works have really been going for Lotte Kopecky, have you ever seen Lorena Wiebes fully 100% commit to chasing something down? And often we've seen in interviews afterwards, she said, I was chasing for Lotte. And you kind of think, well, really? Were you? Because when you see teammates really bury themselves, like Elise Chabet and Celia Jury in Flanders, when they were absolutely gunning into that headwing to pull out the gap from the group behind, they buried everything. And then in the end, they end up miles back on the results sheets, because when they're done, they are done and they are gone, rather than, coming into the velodrome and winning the sprint for sixth or whatever it was. And so that is what I mean when I don't believe that these wins are going to change their mentality with thinking, maybe it could be me. But in a situation like we had in Roubaix, where they've got six really good riders, and actually this comes back to sort of kind of disagreeing with something that you said earlier, Rose, about being a solo victory, and that sort of leading into the problem of the lack of race coverage that we have, because so much of that teamwork to get Franzi into the position that she was done by the team before we were even able to see it, as an aside. So when you've got this situation, like you're at Roubaix, you don't have Vollering, that out-and-out leader, but you do have two riders who, Elise Chabet, who's got a really good record in this race, Franzi Koch, who is just a perfect kind of rider for this race. And that is the opportunity when, yes, you can turn around, and this, both of those riders can turn around and put their hands up and say, yeah, this is for me. And as well, the team can then sort of shape calendars a little bit around that.
It's interesting, Paris-Roubaix seemed like the in, you know, it's easy to say this in hindsight, although you didn't say in hindsight, you said it with foresight, Lizzie. You know, Paris-Roubaix is the perfect race for Franzi Koch because it was a race, you know, from the front or, you know, out or out the back. And it would be interesting to see if the way she races has to evolve now, because apart from Paris-Roubaix, which is a kind of race in a very unique way, she's often ridden by getting herself in the break kind of early on. That's how she got her brilliant result in Strade Bianche, or that's where it came from. And whether or not she's able to get in the break so often now, whether or not she wants to be in the break so often as she used to be, maybe whether or not she wants to save herself for later in the race, it will be interesting to watch how her racing style evolves. And but it's a nice problem to have for the team. And I think they've got so many options. It's just, even if they do go into a race with Vollering as the leader, for example, in certain races, as they showed in Strade Bianche, they've got options when that plan A doesn't work.
Yeah, and I don't think she needs to be in the break either, because we have you know, races that are really tactical races, and we also have races that are really selective races, you know. And Roubaix wasn't hilly, of course, but it was selective in the sense of the riders went out the back rather than out the front. She has the strength now with this new, you know, I don't want to get trapped into the, has she lost weight? Oh, Lizzie Banks is talking about her weight headline. But, you know, she has leaned up, and that has helped her on the hills. And she is a different type of rider to the Franzi Koch we used to see. And often that just happens with age and with racing more. And, you know, we've seen it with Zoe Backstead as well. She came in as a teenager, and she totally did not need to lose any weight. She was so powerful. And it was just a thing that has sort of slowly, naturally happened. She's sort of leaned up a bit. And now we're seeing her in the front at Flanders, because that tiny bit of, I'm going to get criticized here if I say excess weight, but whatever, that tiny bit of fat reserves that have now gone down has made the difference as to whether or not she can get over that hills. And I feel like that is what has happened with Franzi Koch, whether you want to say it out loud or not. We all know it. You know, it's enabled her to really be at the front, and so not have to rely on to getting into the breakaway, because she will almost certainly just be there in the end in those races that are more selective.
It was a beautiful thing also to see her win, and how emotional and how overcome she was by the occasion, and how she had won it and clinched it against those two great champions. That was Pauline Ferrand-Prévot and Marianne Vos. And it should be said, you know, we were talking, you mentioned earlier, Lizzie, about, you know, domestiques really going all in and giving it their all for their teammate. I mean, that was Pauline Ferrand-Prévot. I mean, it was unreal, wasn't it? The amount of effort she put in to keep Marianne Vos up in the position. And every time, you know, Franzi Koch made an acceleration, Pauline Ferrand-Prévot had to come back from it. She did. She just gave absolutely everything to that. And it was kind of emotional on so many levels, wasn't it? I mean, we had this kind of surprise win from Franzi Koch, which was amazing. And she was obviously absolutely delighted. But also this kind of other narrative going on with Marianne Vos, who lost her dad. He passed away after a serious illness, which had seen her take off time from racing to be with him. And Pauline Ferrand-Prévot said that she came in at the last minute to try and help Marianne Vos win and give her all. And that's what we saw, wasn't it, Denny, from Visma Lisa Biker. And you could see, actually, I mean, we pick out Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, but we could see the whole team. That's what they wanted to do, because they were really bossing the cobbles unlike any other team out there.
Yeah, I mean, we pointed out just what a brilliant race they had as a team overall on Sunday. But yeah, it was a bittersweet moment watching Franzi Koch win, wasn't it? Because, you know, she was a popular winner, and you could see that when she crossed the line, Megan Jastrab and others kind of congratulating her, you know, riders from other teams. And it was a great breakthrough moment for her. But clearly, after what Marianne Vos had gone through, a victory for her would have been probably, you know, even more popular. And, you know, the tears which came out of her, which were very rare for Marianne Vos after the race, just showed, you know, just how much she'd been through. You know, her father's funeral was only a few days before. She'd kind of spent the winter with him after, because of his illness, and she skipped the cyclocross season. She pulled out of Milan San Remo to spend time with the family.
And even, Denny, going back as far as the World Champs in Rwanda in September. So it's been such a long and drawn out emotional process, you know, 7-8 months.
Her kind of dedication to her family is kind of really well documented, isn't it? And then for Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, you know, to then decide to race for Mariana was so such a touching moment, wasn't it? I mean, she's quoted saying, when I heard that Henk had passed away, I immediately called the team and said I wanted to ride Roubaix for Mariana. And that was, and you know, the way she rode it, she was clearly just putting it all on the line for Mariana Vos. It was a beautiful, beautiful thing to see.
I completely agree with you, Danny. And I think that, you know, that there has been some criticism about, oh, did Visma Lisa Bike race this right? You know, they were there with two teammates. You know, should they have done this differently? And you could criticize them for that, but that's just not what that performance was about at all. It was about showing up and being there for someone that you care about and someone's family member who you care about. And I'm sure we've all experienced that sort of deep pain when someone that we know is grieving and when you would do anything that you can to help them through that grief. And that was the story that we saw. We didn't see Jumbo Visma going to try to win the race with any rider who could. We saw Pauline putting everything on the line to support somebody who was grieving so deeply, whilst she was also in pain herself. And as she said in the French TV interviews, she was also wanting to pay her own homage to Mariana's dad, Henk Vos.
In fact, you know, as a counterpoint to the criticisms of the team, if the fact that Mariana Vos was there competing for the win after everything she'd been through, you know, missing months of preparation, first race back since her father's death, Pauline Ferrand-Prévot coming in at the last minute, you know, when you look at it in that light, the team's performance is even, you know, more remarkable, and you know, and should be applauded even more.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina is sponsored by Sailey, which is an eSIM brought to you by the people behind NordVPN, which can help to dramatically reduce the cost of using your mobile phone whenever you're abroad. Now, it won't be long before summer's here. Perhaps you're lucky enough to have a trip to the Giro d'Italia or the Tour de France or the Tour de France Femme already booked. Or maybe you're just looking forward to a couple of weeks lounging by the pool. Well, you're going to take your mobile phone with you, and obviously you want to carry on using your phone as if you were at home, either for navigation or for downloading the cycling podcast or for posting fantastic pictures on social media. And of course, when you use your phone abroad, those data costs can really add up quite quickly, or you have to think about switching plans to make sure that you can keep a lid on those costs. Well, Sailey can help you to do that, because it's an eSIM which can enable you to reduce dramatically the cost of using your mobile phone abroad. And as you listen to the cycling podcast, you can get a 15% discount on your first Sailey data plan. Go to sailey.com/cycling, that's sailey.com/cycling, and use the code cycling at checkout, or download the Sailey app in your app store and use that code cycling at checkout. Now, things have moved on a lot in recent years. The technology has improved. You no longer have to replace your physical SIM card with another one when you travel to another country. An eSIM from Sailey only needs to be downloaded and installed once. And if you're traveling to multiple countries on your trip, you can select a plan which covers all of the countries you're visiting. And there are lots of other benefits too. Sailey's built-in ad blocker will stop browser ads from loading, and that can dramatically reduce data usage as well. And it's got a built-in VPN. Lots of benefits to a Sailey eSIM. Go to sailey.com/cycling and use that code cycling at checkout to get a 15% discount.
Well, one of the really interesting talking points actually from the Cobbled Classics is the injury list we have. And it hasn't felt really like it's been a huge kind of crash fest. Certainly Paris-Roubaix wasn't marred by loads of major crashes, was it? But this injury list has been slowly growing, hasn't it, through the classics. Obviously, we had a huge one at Strade Bianche coming off the descent of the Cipressa, which took out Cachenivia Doma there. And then in Flanders, there was a very major one on the run into the Koppenberg, where we lost Marlon Reusser there and Kim LeCourt from competing. But yeah, how does that kind of set us up, Lizzie, looking ahead to the Ardennes that we've got coming? I know I'm coming to you because I know you have literally all the medical reports up there, all the doctor's files.
I've got the list of breakages. Unfortunately, the list of breakages of bones. I have to say that the majority of the medical list comes out of the one big crash that we had going into the Koppenberg, or just before the entry into the Koppenberg at Flanders, where Malin Reusser most notably crashed. And of course, we didn't get to see that fight between her and Demi Vollering that we'd have wanted to see. And we thought, well, maybe we'll be able to see it in the Ardennes. But she has fractured one of her lumbar vertebrae. And it is a stable fracture, and they're going to have conservative management, so no surgery. But still, that doesn't really give us the information about when she'll be back, hopefully for the Tour de France. But it's something that is sort of how long is a piece of string. And another of the big classics and Ardennes favourites, Kim LaCourte from Aegean Sorens Soudal, who has a fractured wrist. So definitely not going to be back in time for the Ardennes. Sarah Gigante, who is a longtime listener and friend of the podcast, is also unfortunately not going to be back in the Ardennes for that team. Wasn't there in Flanders, but she's recovering from a broken femur still. Elena Cecchini, who was riding her last ever Flanders because she's retiring at the end of the year, she had a broken little finger that required surgery. And maybe, you know, not one of the Ardennes favourites, but worth mentioning, Caroline Anderson from Livaluulajaakko, she had a fractured elbow and shoulder ligament damage. And that was all in that crash, apart from Sarah Gigante, just before they went into the Koppenberg. So quite a big injury list. If you put that as well with Brodie Chapman, who had a fractured pelvis, which was a crash a little bit earlier on her own for UAE ADQ, and Eleanor Backstead, absolutely loyal, really, really amazing domestique, who she crashed in Dapana, was it? Or whatever, what's the new name for Dapana now? The Bruges Classic?
Ronda van Brugge, isn't it?
There we go. And she's got a fractured sacrum. Yeah, so that's just some of the crash list. Then one very notable one that I should mention from Roubaix, just because of how bad the crash was. Camilla Acebo, I'm very sorry, Camilla, for mashing your name. Young rider, former junior cross-country skiing world champion and European youth mountain biking champion. She was 12th in Omloop her Nieuwsblad this year, sixth in Le Samin. So it's not a name that you were would have heard, but somebody who was really up and coming, really exciting to watch. She had a fractured jaw, a fractured elbow, and a bleed on the brain from an early crash in Roubaix. So we are just sending our thoughts and healing vibes over to Camilla. And I think, Danny, you were going to give a rundown of the injury list from before that, from San Remo as well.
I don't know if I can follow that such a comprehensive report, but I mean, yeah, I mean, Milan-San Remo, there was that horror crash, wasn't there, on the descent. And of course, Deborah Silvestri, which I think you've looked into her injuries, haven't you, Lizzie? But
5 ribs. Oh, that's something you want to have on the barbecue, not on the X-ray reports.
Not Deborah Silvestri's ribs, of course. But yeah, obviously, she's going to have a long recovery from that. Kasia Niewiadoma was one of the riders caught up in that crash. She got off relatively lightly, skin rash and bruises from what we understand. So she should be back for the Ardennes Classics, which we'll be talking about as well. I think the other thing, it's not so much an injury, but illness. Elisa Longo Borghini has been suffering with illness. Her problems began at Milan-San Remo when she was ruled out of the morning of the race after falling ill. And then she returned at Tvarsdor Vlaanderen, but she was still suffering there. She did manage 8th at Flanders, but then pulled out of Paris-Roubaix after struggling with respiratory problems, according to reports. So, yeah, not been a great spring for her. And I guess all of this is pointing towards the Ardennes, isn't it? Because a lot of these riders that we've highlighted are all riders that you would expect to be contenders for the upcoming Ardennes Classic. So that will hang heavy over the kind of the shape of the Ardennes Classics week.
Yeah, I wonder does that leave us? Does this kind of put everything into sort of Demi Vollering's hands, or you know, might we see a breakthrough in the Ardennes? Because I think that the Ardennes Classics, I'm already starting to question what I'm about to say, which I was going to say, it's, you know, a great place to have these kind of breakthrough rides. You know, we saw Kim LaCourte, didn't we, winning at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. But just as I'm saying, I'm thinking about all the, like, 20 times that Anna van der Breggen won Flèche Wallonne in a row. And I'm starting to kind of doubt what I'm saying. But, you know, where do we see it, Lizzie? How do you see it? Do you think we're going to see some surprises, or is it going to be kind of all playing into Vollering's hands? I should say, actually, one person that we are going to be looking out for, of course, is Magdalene Valliere, the new world champion, or is it new anymore? But this year's world champion. And which does give a perfect chance for me to mention that we have a Friends of the Podcast special coming out. I believe it might even be out as you're listening to this, or it's certainly coming out this week. And that's my conversation with Magdalene Villiers, who will be targeting the Ardennes Classic. But yeah, Lizzie, where do you see the wins going? Where do you see the opportunities going?
You mentioned Anna van der Breggen, and she has been unbeaten in every time that she has ridden this race since 2014. Because
that, okay, yeah, but I think we have to give a bit of context to that stat.
So she won 7 years in a row, absolute undisputed queen of the Muir. Then, of course, she retired before unretiring, and she came back last year. But last year she was unwell, and she pulled out and on the morning of the race and didn't start in Flèche Wallonne last year. So I'm actually really, really curious to see the return of Anna van der Breggen, you know, in this part of the season. She's been away. She's been up at altitude, similar to Mags Valieres, who's also been away and up at altitude. She had a really, Mags Valieres had a super good ride at Strade Bianche. Anna van der Breggen also, I think, is looking in promising form this season. You never really know with Anna van der Breggen, a bit like you never really know with Lotte Kopecky. They're both pretty hard to read. But I think that nobody can read the Muir like she can. But equally, I think that Kasia Nieuwiedoma-Finney, has been in excellent form. Yes, Denny, there is question marks after that big crash at Milan-San Remo. When riders do have problems or concussions or whatever it is, they often, you know, don't publicize them. So we hope that what she's been saying on social media, that everything's fine and she's training really well, is true. But she's super hungry for a win. But as we've discussed so many times before, does she have the team? Like on paper, she's got a really good team to support her. She's got Neve Bradbury, Antonia Niedermayer, Cecilia Otrup-Ludwig, but they just haven't been cutting the mustard for various reasons this year. And so then that brings us back to Demi Vollering and her super strong team, and the fact that none of those riders from her super domestique and domestique list have been susceptible to injury or illness that have sort of taken them out for long periods this season. So I would say if you were one of the other riders, I'd be pretty worried. But again, there's nothing to lose.
I do think it's amazing actually looking at the preliminary start list for the Amstel Gold Race that I'm seeing Francie Kock back again. It's like, is she ever going to have a holiday? Is she ever going to just celebrate her phenomenal season? But I mean, they're certainly taking, I mean, they seem to now, don't they, FTJ, have a number of A teams. I think we, at the beginning of the season, there was kind of a clear line between what we thought was the Vollering team, which was the A team, and the B team, which didn't have Vollering in it. But you can't say that anymore, can you? I mean, this is very much an A team. Demi Vollering obviously has the support of Elise Chabet and Francie Kock there. So yeah, be really interested to see how she gets on. But I mean, EF Education Oatley, actually, we're talking about Magdalene Valliere, they have a huge amount of pedigree in this kind of race, in terms of they've got the backing of Kristen Faulkner, Cedrine Kerbal, Noemi Rugg. They're a really strong team that I think people aren't necessarily going to be looking at.
Yeah, nobody really knows where Kristen Faulkner's at. She's been away. She's been away for a long time. She's been at the Pan Am Champs, so she is the Pan Am champion, and in the time trial. And she came back and over to Europe, and she sort of got immediately put in as a surprise to Flanders. And so she wasn't sort of, you know, she was jet lagged. She just traveled. She sort of wasn't where she needed to be. But I don't think that is necessarily representative of the form that we're going to see from her. So that'll be really, really interesting to see.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's important to kind of, you know, remind ourselves, of course, that all three races, although they share a lot in common with their kind of, you know, the explosive climbs that they have, they're all three, they're very different races in their own right. And of course, this, we can only see at the time of recording the full start list for Amstel Gold Race. We don't have the full start list yet for Flèche Wallonne or Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And, you know, the potential winners of Amstel Gold Race are not necessarily the potential winners of Flèche Wallonne, although Demi Vollering did, of course, win all three back in 2023, wasn't it? Lorena Wiebes is one to watch on for the Amstel Gold Race, for example. That's a race which she had targeted from the beginning of the season. She's came so close to winning that race a couple of years ago, only to celebrate too early and for Marianne Vos to pip her to the line. So I'm sure she, you know, she has unfinished business, and that is a race that can suit a rider like her, who can, you know, has got a fast finish but can also get over the climbs. Very different from the skill set you'll need in Flèche Wallonne. And I was looking at Peters's run into this, the Ardennes Classics this year, because she's had quite a similar build up, arguably slightly lighter raced to one she had last year when she took the win at Flèche Wallonne. Similar kinds of results. You know, she's always been in the top 10 or thereabouts for races. So I'm kind of really curious to see whether she can repeat the form that got her to the top of the Muir de Huy last year.
There's so much more uncertainty about Amstel Gold Race, isn't there? There are so many more variables, where I feel with Liège, Bastogne Liège, for instance, it is so much more attritional. And at the end, yes, you often have a breakaway, and will that breakaway get chased down or not? But with Amstel Gold, because of the nature of the terrain, sort of up and down and left and right all the time, there's just so much more that can happen. If a breakaway gets away, it's much harder to get it back than it is in a race like Liège or even in Flèche Wallonne. And in the past, it has always historically given us really, really exciting racing, these really close finishes, these really close catches of the breakaway, these really close final attacks, whether or not they get caught over the top of the Kauberg with that flat run into the finish. And so I think if there's a race for FDJ to be beaten in, then Amstel Gold is definitely it out of the three of the Ardennes Classics.
Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Well, let me take this moment to introduce our mini feature for this month. And that is about Paris-Roubaix, debutantes at Paris-Roubaix. I'm going to be speaking to Shirin van Anroy, who was a real surprise that she hasn't done Paris-Roubaix before.
I swear to God, she has done it at least three times.
I know, possibly even won it. No, you'll find out why, the intriguing reason why that is in the feature. Also hearing from Alexis Magna and a young talent, only 18, Jente Kopes. Well, here it goes. If any race favours experience over youth, it's Paris-Roubaix. The brutality of it, the technicality of it, the sheer necessity of the luck involved. It is a race like no other. So what if you're embarking on this most predictably unpredictable of races and you've never raced it before? We hear the testimonies of three very different riders, all of whom raced Paris-Roubaix for the first time this year, about how they fared and about all the hopes, fears and ambitions that they brought to it. We'll hear from Alexis Magna, back racing full-time in Europe after several years in the US, and 18-year-old Jente Kopes in her first year out of the junior ranks. But we first hear from Shirin van Anroy. The fact that 2026 was van Anroy's first Paris-Roubaix will come as a surprise to most. The Little Trek rider is a champion cyclocrosser and a former winner of Trofeo Binder. She has been for many years an integral part of her team's classics campaign, but never at Paris-Roubaix. She embarked on this year's race with a point to prove.
In 2014, we, like with the club that I was riding for back then, when I was still a youth rider, we went to ride on the Roubaix cobbles, I think like the last 60 or 80 kilometers, because like one of the members from the club was Servaas Knave, and he won the 2001 edition. So yeah, he took all of us there. I did say, I think back then, like to my parents, like that I really liked it and that I would love to do this race. But like, of course, back then there was no women's Paris-Roubaix yet. I really wanted to race it already a few times because I thought it's nice as a cyclocross rider as well to do Paris-Roubaix. But then, yeah, not all the DSs really agreed that it would be a race for me. A lot of them actually thought that, maybe I would be a bit too light. But yeah, it was nice to race it this year and discover that I really like it and I would love to come back the upcoming years. Yeah, it felt a bit like I wanted to show and prove like myself that, okay, I can do it. But I think to really go and get like a result in Roubaix, you need to like have the full support or like full belief from everyone around you that you can do it. And also that like to already know what's going to happen. Like it was the first time I knew it was going to be absolute chaos. I did one recon or two recons and like, okay, then of course you feel that the cobbles are shit. But then once you're really there in the race with 120 girls around you, it's even worse. I think I was more nervous just because it's like a fight over and over and over again. When we had this lead out into the important sector and we were just riding like 60K an hour on the flat, that's the part where I struggled the most. And also just because I didn't know what to expect. Like before Flanders, I think I can dream the entire course. And with this one, I had no clue. I just knew it was going to be hectic, chaotic, dangerous, everything at the same time, and then I just wanted to survive. Also, like being a smaller rider, I don't see anything in front of me, so I just need to trust the rider. If you're not there, the race is just over. Not even because maybe you don't have the legs, but just if you're out of position, there's no way you're getting to the front again on these cobbles. Also with flat tires, puncture, like, yeah, you also just need to have a lot of good luck in this race. I think I did pretty well. I only had one blister. So not too bad, but then yeah, towards the end you could feel that that blister was actually going to be a bit annoying, but yeah, I guess then you just need to push harder to make sure your legs hurt even more than your hands. I didn't realize before the start how fast everything would like follow up and that all of a sudden you would just be done with the race.
Yeah, I'm sure not everyone says that. I'm sure people have
plenty. No, I think I was also just on a good day, so that also helped, because yeah, I think if you're in a like nice group and you're in a good flow, then you also find some momentum on the cobbles. And I think otherwise, if you're like not on a good day, every cobble feels like one too much. And then it's a lot of cobbles to get to Roubaix. All of a sudden you come into this velodrome knowing that you finished Roubaix, but also just with all the spectators. And I didn't realize it was also still for position 6, I think that my group was, but that was already special. And I was just after the race, like, oh, imagine being like one of the riders sprinting here for the victory in this velodrome. So yeah, I think I definitely want to come back and try to go for the win here.
At just 18 years old, Jente Kopes of Human Powered Health was the youngest rider to finish the race this year, both in the men's and women's races. She's in her first pro year, having spent last year competing in the junior ranks. To put that into context, that's like going from competing in 60 to 90 kilometre races to races now lasting 140 to 160 kilometres with all the best cyclists in the world. Add to that the cobbles, chaos and intensity of Paris-Roubaix, it's a big step up and one that she really wasn't expecting.
They told me that I was doing the recon to just see how it goes. But already before the recon, they told me that I was in the race. So, but I wasn't expecting it, actually. I was also not expecting to already be a professional cyclist now. So also not this race. Paris-Roubaix, the name already says so much. So everyone, of course, was really hyped. And also, we did a recon a few weeks before the race, so that's also different. You don't do that with a lot of races. I was with some teammates and also with Magnus Bechstedt, who is our DS, and he also won this race. So he really helped us a lot. But the first time on the cobbles, it was not bad. I was just enjoying it, actually. I really loved it, yeah. Of course, he learned us some lines and things, but also in the race, it's always different. So I think you also need to feel it a bit. And also, yeah, it's the thing with cobbles. If you go faster, it's less painful. It's really shit to hear, maybe, but it's the truth. It was a long day, but yeah, my role was a bit to try to go with a first group. But there was not really a first group, only one rider in the front. And then we tried to position for the third sector, but it was really hard to position there. And then it was a bit more chasing the whole race. I've seen the race more from behind than in the front. My family was there, but I didn't hurt them. I think I was suffering too much. It's more normally you have like only pain in your legs, but now it's just your whole body was sore. And yeah, it's just the whole body what is painful. I just really wanted to see the velodrome. Yeah, I just wanted to do my lap there. Yeah, I just wanted to finish it. I sit there in the velodrome for a few minutes and then I went back to the bus.
And were you sitting in the velodrome to kind of take it in, or was it just like, I can't move anymore?
Both. No, but more to take in the moment. And yeah, just so that I never forget it. It's a thing I'm going to say for the rest of my life that I finished it. I can't wait until next year.
Alexis Magna, nay Alexis Ryan, came close to racing Paris-Roubaix once before, back in 2021, the very first women's Paris-Roubaix. But by that point, she was close to quitting cycling altogether. Drained by having competed for 9 years as a pro, she headed home to the States and the crit racing scene to find her love of the bike again. Fast forward to the end of 2025, and she had just signed a contract with EF Education Oatley to return to Europe full-time, when she suffered a catastrophic, life-threatening crash. Her physical rehabilitation was remarkable, but unsurprisingly, her mental recovery took a little longer. Still feeling the fear grip even in this year's Gent-Wevelgem, it took her debut at Paris-Roubaix, that roughest and hardest of races, to paradoxically finally find her flow.
2021 was the first year it happened, and that was my last year on Canyon, but it happened in October. I was like burnt out, really burnt out by like end of August, so I didn't make it to Roubaix. I did the recon and everything. Even when we were doing the recon with my current team, and I was like, I remember all this, even though it was 5 years ago. I don't remember it the same way. Like, it's like the light is different in the memory, you know? Like, it was just like, I didn't enjoy myself on the recon in 2021 at all. And then this year, it's like, I was having fun and like really happy to be there. It was the coolest race that I have ever done. Like, hands down, my favorite race now, like, takes the cake. Oh, it's just like, it's just a bike racer's race, you know? Like, you have to be good at all of it. And if you're not good at all of it, it shows. The minute the race started, I had this sense that we just had to be at the front, like the whole race. Like, you couldn't leave the top 20. Like, that's just how it felt. So I was literally just like at the front, even in the wind. I was just riding in the wind. I was like, I need to be here. I can't go back. Like, if I go back, I'm never going to see the front again. It was true, because like those people that I was around for the first 20K of the race were the people that were like in that front group at the end. I wasn't afraid in Roubaix at all. And like, you have to be so aggressive. Like, you can't give in like 1 second. You can't give up to anybody. And the fear is what makes you like lose position. And then I crashed out at 85K. It was not a graceful crash too. It was like just kind of yard sale. And like, I got back on the bike and I realized I broke my shifter. And I was like, oh, I need a bike. Oh, yeah, I remember thinking to myself, I am riding through that effing velodrome. I want to experience this race. I am going to finish this race. But on Carrefour de la Race, I was like blowing up so hard. Really just like wanted to kind of stop pedaling. It was one of those moments. But the fans were just screaming so loud and cheering for us, because obviously we had some serious pain faces on. And they got me to the end of the sector. It was so cool. And then riding under the velodrome was like, wow. Yeah, it was super special. Really, really special. The one feeling that like really sticks with me from this race is like how I felt when I was in the group. Like, I haven't felt that way in a really long time. I didn't feel that way like when I was racing crits. And I didn't feel that way probably the last 2 years that I was on Canyon. Like, this, it's just like a level of focus, I guess, that's like flow state, I guess is what you could call it. But like my brain was switched off and I was just like pure, like sort of animal instinct, I guess you could say, where all I was doing was racing and I wasn't thinking about anything. I wasn't thinking about fear. I wasn't thinking about like expectation. I was literally just racing. I never felt like the race was hectic. that was what was so crazy about it. I was literally just like so calm. The bunch felt calm to me. Like, and then when I talked to my teammates, they had like the complete opposite experience. They were like, it was insane. We couldn't get to the front. It was so crazy. And I was like, I don't know what everybody's talking about. It was just pretty chill. Kind of like a zen state, flow state, whatever you want to call it.
Well, we heard there from our three Paris-Roubaix debutantes, and obviously you heard there a lot about the kind of chaos and craziness and the huge fight that happens right from the flag drop at Paris-Roubaix. Of course, this year, we didn't actually get to see much of it at all. In fact, we got to see probably about an hour and a half. And if the riders had been going on the fastest schedule, I think it would have been about an hour of coverage. Part of that, or part of the reason they have got away with that, should I say, is that the women's race, which has always been held on the Saturday before the men's race on Sunday, was moved onto the Sunday, ostensibly for reasons of getting a bigger TV audience by, you know, holding on to the men's audience. But it did mean that we didn't get the coverage that we wanted. Well, Denny, how did you kind of see it? Do you see any advantage in the women racing on the same day as the men, which they do in, they do in all of the kind of major races like Milan-San Remo and Tour of Flanders? They've always raced on the same day as the men.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think as I mentioned in the Arrivée, I think one of the biggest issues with the change, and not just the change and the fact that they were both on the same day, but the fact that the women's race had so little coverage compared to the men's, you know, it was only given 90 minutes, was just a signal it sends about women's cycling, you know, this, that there is a hierarchy, and the women's race, you know, it is not at the top. And you know, on a day when there were four races going on the same course, because he had the men's junior race, the men's under 23 race, the men's elite race, followed by at the end, the women's race, which has a little bit of coverage. The danger is, although I know that ASO, and I'm sure we'll come onto it, you know, argue that the viewing TV viewing figures, at least in France, I don't think we've seen the global audience figures yet, were higher this year compared to previous years by quite considerably. It felt very much like it was what they were getting was kind of the leftovers, you know, sloppy seconds, to use a terrible phrase. It was felt unsatisfactory. And of course, ASO have made the argument that they needed to move for budgetary reasons and so on. But we have seen with the Tour de France Femme, of course, that a race can be raced on its own, in its own right. It doesn't have to be alongside a men's race, and can have brilliant growth in viewing figures and roadside audiences. Last year's Tour de France Femme proved that. The Paris-Roubaix Femme audience was growing year on year. So to switch it back on the same day as the men's race, and then to give it such a short amount of coverage, as you said, Lizzie, you know, we missed so much of the race, or the important build-up. ASO were keen to boast about the new sectors they'd introduced to the race, but we didn't see them raced. So what's the point? So it was really disappointing, and it's hard to put up much of a defence on ASO's behalf, really.
We should say, shouldn't we, that there is kind of two issues going on, where, you know, there's one decision to move it to the Sunday, but then there is a separate decision to give it so little coverage. Because it was happening at the same time as the men's race doesn't actually mean that it can't have any, there can't be any footage of it, can't be any coverage of it until the men are done. That's just not the case. And we don't see that with things like Tour of Flanders. You get much more coverage even when the two races are happening simultaneously. So there is a question there, isn't there, about the decision, you know, choosing to make the decision to have less coverage than we have had actually since the race began in 2021.
There's been a lot of chat saying, oh, we got 90 minutes of coverage, but we didn't. We got 70 minutes of race coverage. which is so, so little in a race like Paris-Roubaix. And as you said, Rose, in Flanders, we had coverage from 90 kilometers to go. That was a different organizer, of course, Flanders Classics, and this is ASO. And I think the thing that really got my goat, there were a few things, just as might surprise you. So Thierry Gouvenou gave an interview to our friends at Cycling News, and I just felt the whole thing had a very accusatory tone. They talked about the financial difficulties. They talked about the difficulties closing the roads, and people in the Paris-Nord area didn't really like it that the roads were closed 2 days in a row. And he said, well, Zwift left us, as if it was Zwift's fault. And he also said, and this really got one of my many goats, I think women's cycling is winning. And I'm sorry, but he is not the one who's going to decide whether women's cycling is winning. It is the fans. It is the riders.
We should say Thierry Gouvenou is the ASO race director. Clearly, these are answers from someone who kind of doesn't want to field the criticism, isn't it? It's kind of trying to distract somewhat, almost. Maybe saying things that are so inflammatory that it distracts from the real issue, which is ASO. And to be honest, also ASO have always been behind the other race organisers, haven't they, in terms of what they offer women cycling? Because it's only really recently, of course, that we've had Paris-Roubaix. I mean, the history of Flanders is far longer, is decades longer. But also other ASO races like Liège-Bastogne-Liège. I mean, Liège-Bastogne-Liège even is not an old race on the women's scene. That's another ASO race. And of course, most notably of all, the Tour de France Femmes, which took years and years and years and years of campaigning, and then they kind of gave a little crumb with, you know, putting on La Course. There was many years of that and kind of using it almost like a strange sort of experimental race.
We should have been thankful for that one day that we did get. And we were, to get up at 5 a.m. and do our race at 9 a.m. And yeah, we were very thankful, but we wanted more. And, you know, this sort of mirrors what he said about in his interview with Cycling News, that in, you know, the women used to start at 8 o'clock in the morning in Liège and they prefer not to do that. And so we've moved them later. Like, well, you know, it's not we're complaining and then we should be really grateful to you. It's about furthering the sport as a whole. And, you know, we were talking before we started recording, Rose, and you were saying, well, is men's cycling growing? Women's cycling is growing. Let's invest in it. And you don't, you know, investing in it is putting in money now to get to the returns in the future. Investing in it is not taking away money now. I'm done.
That's what I find is so strange, is there's, you know, so much focus. And like you said, Denny, like the hierarchy seems to be very much put into the men's side of racing, and of course, you know, they do have a bigger viewership, but you know, where is the growth? We can't say at all that there's any growth in men's cycling at all. I mean, also, you just look at the number of teams that fold, the number of sponsors that pull out, the number of races that disappear, and it's surprising. Well, it doesn't surprise me at all because I've worked in cycling a long time, but it's very short-sighted, you know, a real short-sightedness over where the market will be in the future. I mean, if they could make women's cycling as popular as men's cycling, then they'd have a much more stable business model, wouldn't they? So it seems so odd to put restrictions on women's cycling, not allow it to grow in the way that it could do, and therefore still just have this going into the future, have this huge imbalance, and have men's cycling, which is slowly declining and is certainly not growing, or, you know, people watch it and then they just, an audience that is aging, not to say anything about our listeners, of course, but you know, men's cycling, there, it has got an aging audience. It's kind of lives on former glories in order to prop it up. So it's really odd to not see the business opportunity and the commercial value in backing women's cycling.
Yeah. And it's, you know, of course, I think I said this in the Arriva episode, but, you know, Even if you accept that there were real logistical challenges to holding a race on a separate day because of issues with local authorities, even if you accept that, even if that's completely fair and true, then you've still got the issue of giving women such little coverage at the end, and that's an active decision, you know, to actually say, well, the men are still going to get coverage from the flag drop to the finish, and we'll just fit in the women's race at the end, and as soon as the women's race is finished, we'll cut to the men's podium. You know, that these are all decisions that could have been very different, and they could have given, you know, treated the race very differently. But of course, we, you know, as you say, women's racing does need to be invested in, and it is growing, and if you carry on investing in it, will continue to grow, and then you'll have a better product, or a product that you can sell to more sponsors in the future. And I think this is a backward step in that regard. You know, you're not going to get another Zwift step in if this is the way you're going to treat women's sport.
And well, you're not going to get another Zwift step in if you don't actually try and find one. You know, he wasn't saying in the interview, you know, we really tried hard to find someone to replace Zwift after they'd done an amazing 5 years of sponsoring our race, allowing it to grow so much. If you're a sponsor wanting to come in, you kind of think, well, if that's how they treat a sponsor, just talk about them like that after 5 years of giving a hell of a lot of money to this race. And they're continuing to give money to ASO, let's not forget, because they will be sponsoring the Tour de France until I think 2028 is the current contract. I just find it difficult to believe that you can say something like that in the media when actually you're wanting these investors to come on board so that you can actually finance these races. And when it comes to the amount of time that the coverage was on, in the end of the day, like you say, that's a decision that they made, and it's a financial decision, because then they could have the same commentators for the races world feed, Ant McCrossan and Hannah Walker, covering both of the races, because one stopped, one finished, and then the other one started. So they didn't have to have two sets of commentators. France TV, who were the broadcasters of the race, they didn't have to have double the coverage and, you know, double the number of broadcasters as well. They perhaps didn't have to have double the number of helicopters. So these are all financial decisions. But when they've already removed that, yes, it is a massive financial implication to hold the race separately on the Saturday. They've removed that massive financial implication, and then they're just cutting down from everywhere else that they can, shaving off every last bit of this race that they can, and then all we get is a finish right at the end. I just think it's really unacceptable, and I think that there is clear want and will from the people that we want to see this, even if you have to watch that first bit back because you are watching the men's race. We want to see this. The people want to see this. It has been growing. It has been so successful. The people will go out on the side of the road on the Saturday, even if the men's race isn't coming afterwards.
Yeah, it's interesting when, you know, in the UK, I mean, obviously at the British Continental, we focus on much smaller races, much lower level. But talking to race organisers in the UK, you know, some say, well, actually, if you go to a sponsor and you pitch a race and it's just a men's race only, sponsors aren't interested. You know, sponsors, investment wants to support women's racing. And so, you know, the interest, the money's there as well to invest in women's racing. So that's what I just don't understand. This is the growth area of the sport. And if you genuinely want to follow where the money's going, then that's what you need to, you know, lay the foundations for. You know, I completely agree with you, Liz. You know, to take Thierry Gouvenou's logic, if you carry that, what if Zwift walked away from the Tour de France Femme? You know, what would they do? Just, you know, slot in a stage at the end of for a week at the end in the alongside the Tour de France, the men's Tour de France. I mean, you know, it's just it's just not a rational line of thought at all.
Obviously, you know, I wasn't there, and I don't know the exact ins and outs of the investment at ASO and whether they did look for a sponsor or not, but it is something I have seen time and time and time again in cycling in the past with other races. And so often they just don't have the people who can advocate for women's cycling to the sponsors in the first place. And if you don't have those people that are passionate about the sport, that understand the sport, and really, I'm not saying the people at ASO aren't passionate about cycling and want to sell cycling, but passionate about women's cycling, want to sell women's cycling, understand women's cycling. And then they take that with, you know, a powerful and passionate presentation to the investors. you know, I've seen that time and time and time again, that that is the one person that is missing in these organizations. And that's where it falls down. And that's where the women's side suffers, because you don't have this person that is really desperate in a way to get that investment to continue to move it forward.
It does feel like a particularly sort of cycling problem, doesn't it? I remember, Denny, I think after the Arriva, you said to me, I mean, can you imagine at Wimbledon if they showed all five sets of the men's tennis final and then they just came in for the last couple of games of the women's final? It would be, you know, but it's just one of those things that you would not get that in other sports. It's something like old school, old boys club type mentality that still exists in cycling, that they can still get away with it. And people, you know, obviously are up in arms about it, but, you know, not as angry as, I mean, if that happened at Wimbledon, it would just be absolute shock horror, wouldn't it? But I think that's what's so difficult.
I live very close to Wimbledon here. And, you know, imagine Merton Council saying, well, for logistical for reasons, you can't hold the women's final on Saturday. So you have to, so the organisers go, okay, well, we'll hold it after the men's final, but and we'll just, you know, yeah.
We'll hold it on Monday when everyone's gone home.
yeah, exactly. We'll just, when it will overlap, and yeah, it just doesn't make sense, does it? And yeah, as you say, you just can't imagine that happening in any other sport. But the other interesting point that we made off air, Lizzie, was your point, which I'll let you make, but the point about the fact that by treating women's racing like this, you don't get to see the domestiques in action. You don't get to see the kind of, not the the lesser riders is the wrong word, but you only end up seeing the stars and the same riders, and that impacts a whole range of things, doesn't it?
I can't actually remember if I said that earlier in the podcast or not, but yeah, I think that's been a massive game changer in women's cycling, to allow all riders to increase their pay. Because if you're only getting the riders at the top to increase their pay, and then the riders at the bottom are still barely on a living wage, or, you know, having to have money from mum and dad or a second job or whatever, that doesn't further the sport. You know, what we've seen in recent years is that domestiques have become so valuable because people can finally see the work that they're doing. And so then they get put onto multi-year contracts. And so everybody is more secure, which raises their level, which raises the level of cycling overall. And it's just this positive feedback loop. And so suddenly, in one of the most important races of the year, if we cannot see, you know, we say Franzi Koch did this alone. Well, she didn't do it alone. She had four other riders. You know, we saw Elise Chabé in the group behind, and we saw Celia Jury bring Elise Chabé back. But other than that, we didn't see the work of Vittoria Guazzini. We didn't see the work of the other riders there in FDJ United Suez. And it was so, so important. I mean, I guess the thing that we should be grateful for is that we, generally speaking, in the other races, we can see that work and we do have the coverage that we want in general. So maybe we just shouldn't complain and we should shut up and be grateful for what we have.
Well, we actually are going to shut up now, Lizzie, because I think that basically takes us to the end.
Well, I need to shut up, otherwise I might explode.
I'll take your advice.
My goats will be feeding off me for the literally. Next few days.
But yes, another little reminder, of course, about the Friends special with Magdalene Valliere. That should be out or will be imminent. So make sure you sign up. Make sure you become a friend of the podcast so that you can catch that really interesting conversation. You know, talking about growing up in Canada, you know, racing in -20 and what that looks like. The fact that she learned to ride her bike at the age of 9 and then went on a 1,000-kilometre bike packing trip with her dad. And of course, her amazing triumph at the World Championships as well. She's going to be delving into that. So yeah, make sure you catch that. We will be back. We've got some Arrives on the way, haven't we, from the Ardennes Classic. So you'll be hearing from us then. But yes, Lizzie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rose.
You've taken a breath.
Thinking calming thoughts. I'm just thinking about my favourite race, Flesh Roll On.
I knew that was coming. It had to be. And thank you very much, Denny.
Thank you. It's been nice. I realise this is a full circle moment, because my first appearance on the podcast was with the three of us back in 2023. So it's nice to kind of complete that little circle. So thank you both.
That sounds like you're retiring, Denny. Sounds like that's the end
and
of...
And thank you, listeners.
Yeah. That concludes.
And with that,
goodbye.
See you later.
But yes, well, thank you, listeners. We will be back and we will drag Denny back, whether he wants to come back or not. Don't worry. Be assured of that. Yes, thank you for listening.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.